you know, what people don't appreciate is that everything you get better at while you sleep. That's it. You don't get better at anything while you're awake. Mm-hmm. So if you're not sleeping well, and if you're not sleeping in line with your circadian rhythm, you just don't do that as well.
I agree.
What the fuck do I know?
Yeah. Welcome to Barbell Shrug. I'm Mike Bledsoe here with Doug Larson, and we have Dr. Kirk Parsley. And you're former Navy SEAL. You now specialize in sleep, or have specialized in sleep. You work with a lot of people that have traumatic brain injuries. You work with a lot of people who you're just trying to get people healthy. And some of the work you do is with hormone replacement therapy and doing it in an intelligent way.
Yeah.
What else should we know about you that I may have missed?
I'm a hell of a square dancer, good with Legos. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, your point is exactly, I think, the message I'm trying to get out. I completely unintentionally became the sleep guy. That was never, it was never a goal of mine to be this world renowned expert on
sleep.
That's
usually how it happens though. Yeah. You just start doing something and all of a sudden people are like, oh, you're that guy. I'm like, am I? Oh, yeah. Weird.
Do I want to be that guy?
And it's like, I never tried to be that guy. I didn't want to be that guy, but I guess I ended up being that guy.
Yeah.
And interestingly, this, when I was the SEALs, when I came back to the SEAL teams as their doctor, they were having all these problems that I couldn't really explain any other way. But the one thing that I was finding when I did these huge panels on them, right? I did these huge serum panels of like 98 different serum markers, largely because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Like, I'm just like, I could just shotgun it and like, let's see what pops up. And all their hormones were fucked up. And so I wanted to fix their hormones because I'm a doctor. I'm a medical doctor. That's what they teach me. It's like, hey, this lab says this. You give this, pharmaceutical intervention to fix that.
So we need to bring them to normal.
Right. But unfortunately, the other downside of medicine is that normal has nothing to do with optimal, right? It's just like, it's quote unquote normal. So
normal is normally, this is my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but
Wrong. You're probably wrong, but go ahead.
No, but like in the medical community. The normal is kind of like the average versus what you're saying is optimal.
Yeah,
it's like, the average
nationwide, right? Not even like the average in Southern California, which would look totally different than the average in Northern Texas or, whatever. Iowa or whatever. I don't know. not that I'm bashing any of those places. I live in Texas. My dad lives in Iowa, so it's all good. But things like
he's lived there.
It's like being a minority. You can make fun of a minority. If you are one. So I can make fun of people in the Midwest because I'm from the Midwest. Kind of the South Midwest. Oh, shit, I don't know. I never claim to be smart, man. If you look at something like, we'll just take a random number, like total testosterone, which by and large is a stupid number, doesn't mean a whole lot. But the normal range for this is 250 to 1,100 nanograms per deciliter. Pretty fucking big range, man. So what do you do if
the experience at 250 to 1,100 are two completely different experiences.
Completely different world. Right. It's like saying one drink or three bottles of Jack. Like, what makes you, what's intoxication? Huge range, right? Like that wouldn't even be close. Mm-hmm. And so like total testosterone comes from Framingham data. And if you're not familiar with Framingham, it's a little town in Massachusetts. It was filled with all sort of northern white European immigrants. I mean, this was only 50, 60 years ago. So, but it didn't have a lot of flux, right? The people who lived there tend to live there their whole lives. So it was an easy population to study. It was close to the Ivy League schools. And so that's the population they studied. Mm. When they decided to do total testosterone, what's normal, and that's all they could measure at the time, was total. The criterion for being normal was you had to be 19 or older. Okay. You had to have testicles, and you had to be alive. If you met those three.
It's rigorous.
Yeah. You met those three criterion, you were part of the story. Like, you were part of the normal range. Right. So the 82-year-old guy at the nursing home, who the most physical thing he ever does is this, is 250, right? The 19-year-old guy who's out getting after it is 1,100.
Yeah. I feel like if you take this out of the intangibles of, like, what are my blood markers, and you put it into the physical world, like, if you said, like, if you're older than 19 and you're a male and you're alive, what is the range for, like, your mile time? What's the normal range? And it's like 5 minutes to 25 minutes. Like, what's good? Well, I'm within five, like my mile time's between 5 and 25, so I'm normal, so I'm good.
Great metaphor.
Even if your mile time's like 18 minutes, like, you, like, how'd as far you, as athletes you know are my concerned. Mile time? Yeah, that's like a slow walk almost. Like, yeah. So to be normal is not good at all in that example. When you pull it out of the intangible and put it in the physical real world, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, this doesn't make sense at all. What's good for me? Like,
right.
What's optimal for someone that's my age and is relatively healthy?
Right. And that's, you know, and that's exactly how I got into this, because, like I said, I wanted to fix the hormones. I wasn't the military medicine, most conservative kind of medicine, it's way worse than just academic medicine, right? This is big government-controlled medicine policy. They weren't about to let me give SEALs hormones because, you know, within 6 months, there'd be an admiral on CNN having to explain why all SEALs take steroids, right?
Right.
SEALs are on anabolic steroids.
And from what I've heard, that's been a little bit of flux on what's – there's been times where it's been more available and less available.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, probably 15 or 20 years ago, probably 15 years ago, when organizations like Cenogenics really started marketing this low T, you know, concept, this menopause, andropause, whatever, those types of clinics started becoming available to everybody, because by and large, they were... I wouldn't say they're snake oil salesmen, but they were kind of irresponsibly treating people. They were just going, we'll put you at the high end of the range and you feel great, so I must be a great doctor. It's like, yeah, well, if I gave you cocaine every day, you'd feel fucking great too, but that wouldn't make me a good doctor, right? So, like, you need to be responsible about how you treat it. But like
they're siloing this one thing. They're looking at one marker and not paying attention to the system as a whole.
Yeah, and I actually trained with them maybe 10 years ago, and I'd already been training under... like brilliant guys who'd been doing this stuff for 40 years. But you know, I needed some kind of plaque I could put on my wall that proved that I had been through some certification. And, I sat in this 3-day training, which was by and large teaching me how to be a telemarketer to try to get people into the program. But the little bit of actual medicine and hormonal replacement they talked about, they were just fucking wrong. Like, they just didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Like, I knew way more than the instructors. The one guy who came in and did female hormone replacement, he was pretty smart, but Cenogenics, like 90% of their population were males. So anyways, like, you know, if we take testosterone as one of the examples, and that I'm just taking it because it's familiar and everybody talks about it. There were 20 other markers that I wanted to fix on these team guys because they didn't have disease. You know, the medical system, one of the screwed up things about the medical system is if you don't have a disease, I can't treat you, right? I have to have an ICD-10 code to put on there to say, this is why I'm giving you this medication. And there's a book or course or algorithm somewhere to tell me that's what I'm supposed to do. If you hit this lab value, then I do this. And if you don't hit that lab value, I don't do anything. Right? Like, you don't even have diabetes if your fasting blood glucose is 124. I go, got nothing for you, man. Work on your diet, I guess. Like, exercise more. But if once you hit 125, oh, dude, you know, you're pre-diabetic. Let's get in here. Let's start giving you some pills.
Right.
But anyways, I didn't really have the option of treating these guys. And the other thing is, when you get into an organization like the SEAL teams or professional athletes or pilots or whatever, a lot of medication is disqualifying from your job, which is the worst thing you can do, right?
Like, yeah.
a guy comes to see you because he's having problems performing in his job, and you disqualify him from his job. Well, you're the hero now, right? Like, you're probably going to end up dead in a parking lot somewhere. So,
yeah.
But, you know, the guys trusted me because I'd been a SEAL, and I had a good reputation as a SEAL, and so they came and they would chat with me about it, and I found all these things off, and I wanted to fix them. And kind of the one unifying theory I could talk about was sleep, because, you know, all of your anabolic hormones are produced while you're sleeping. Mm. And now your anabolic behavior is happening when you're sleeping. Your thyroid is getting balanced out and your stress hormones are getting balanced out. And vitamin D3 is important for sleep, and magnesium is important for vitamin D3 reactions and for sleep. And so that kind of allowed me to talk about hormones under the guise of sleep, right? It was a total sleight of hand. Like, here's my sleep lecture, and it was like 90% hormones.
Gotcha. You're like scooting around the system a little bit.
But I had this kind of unique perspective on sleep, which most people weren't saying then, which is the mainstream story now, right? About photo period, you know, light saturation, you know, sleep hygiene, how nutrition affects sleep, how sleep affects nutrition and appetite and mood control and all this stuff. And then I also talked about, you know, SEAL specific training and operations, right? Obviously they work at night because that's when we have the advantage. We have nods, they don't. So, you know, why wouldn't you fight at night? Like, so they need to train at night. So they're oftentimes working at night, sleeping during the day. All right, so that's screwed up circadian rhythms, and then you can explain a lot of maladies with that. Mm. And again, these guys didn't have disease. They weren't coming in clinically depressed. They weren't coming in suicidal. You know, they weren't coming in with diabetes or even pre-diabetes or whatever. They were coming in with poor insulin sensitivity. They were coming in with low motivation. They were coming in with like labile mood, just meaning they flip-flop back and forth with their mood without even really knowing why. Mm. And
is all that just a result of just intense training for years and very, very low amounts of sleep?
Well,
for talking about sleep?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the chaotic sleep cycles, right? Because, you know, what people don't appreciate is that everything you get better at while you sleep. That's it. You don't get better at anything while you're awake. Mm-hmm. So if you're not sleeping well, and if you're not sleeping in line with your circadian rhythm, you just don't do that as well. So these are super high performing guys, right? Top of the top, right? Mm-hmm. Creme de la creme, as they say. And these guys are used to performing here. And 10 years later, when they should be peaking, their performance is dropping off to here. And they're like, why the hell is my performance dropping off? Like, I've trained rigorously. I do what the exercise, you know, with what my strength and conditioning coach tells me to do. I eat what Rob Wolf tells me to eat, you know, like whatever. They totally geek out about their health and their performance starts declining. Those are the guys who came to see me. Hmm. And I would have, at that time I would have hoped that they had something that I could diagnose and then go, here's that pill and they'll fix it. Cause that's how I got trained in medicine. Mm-hmm. I have subsequently learned that traditional medicine is not healthcare at all, right? It's disease care. If you don't have a disease, I got nothing for you as an MD. I mean, what makes somebody healthy? What makes somebody high performing? Sleep, nutrition, exercise, and stress control, right? You have to optimize those four pillars. It's like the four tires on a car. Your buddy pulls up in front of your house with three wheels on his car, gets out and it's like, dude, this thing's performing like shit. I think the fuel injectors are clogged. Are the fuel injectors clogged? Could be. But let's put the tire on first and then see how it performs, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you optimize those four pillars. And that really gave me the perspective in medicine that I was like, well, I have to optimize these guys' lifestyle, which required me to, you know, lobby and try to change certain aspects about training as well, because they had to have the right environment to be able to optimize their lifestyle. And then we do things to mitigate, because I can tell you, especially if I'm doing labs on you and talking with you regularly, like I can tell you what ideal is, but there's reality. You know, reality and ideal very rarely meet each other, no matter how motivated you are.
Yeah.
So in that bridge is where we start using little mitigating techniques and, you know, things like napping and things like stimulants for, you know, long night ops or whatever, or, you know, whatever, nutritional supplements or sleep supplements or, you know, whatever, you know, just giving that one category. But you can do that for every category.
So you're talking about just picking the low-hanging fruit first.
Yeah.
And this happens with everybody. I mean, I went up to, well, I have a lot of friends in the entrepreneurial space who are not necessarily health or fitness oriented, and they are doing a lot of the bulletproof
stuff, man.
A lot of the biohacking.
Of course.
And, you know, I go over to a friend's house, and he's like, dude, you got to get on this vibration plate. And this is all the stuff it does. And I'm like, oh, cool. He's like, you should get one. I was like, nah, I'm good.
I just exercise.
And he's like, why? I was like, well, all this stuff that you just mentioned it is good for is, I achieve that with movement.
Right.
Plus I get all these additional benefits.
Way more benefits with the movement. Yeah.
And so it's funny to me. And I think Kelly Starr, I went to the Bulletproof conference and I think he did a really good job of addressing this, because if you go to Paleo FX, you go to that conference, you got one type of crowd.
Yeah.
And if you go to Bulletproof, it's a different type of crowd. And there's some crossover there too. Like, the perspectives are similar in a lot of ways. And then the type of person it attracts is very different. So, like, what I've seen is, like, the paleo crowd is, like, everyone's into movement and just, like,
right.
And, like, I don't know, kind of being in their bodies and being here. And with Bulletproof, it's
well, they're performance oriented around their physical body. Whereas the entrepreneurs, C-level executives, all those guys that Ashbury attracts, they want to optimize their, you know, the neck up of the cognitive performance, their decision making ability, their, you know, how long they can work without collapsing, like all that stuff is what they're really focused on. And then, you know, there's a little bit of ego and aesthetic shit going on below the neck. But for the most part, it's like they don't care how much they bench press or how fast they run a mile or what their Fran time is. Like, they don't care.
it is comical, though, like buying like a $5,000 machine that shakes you.
Yeah.
When it's like, well, you could just go spend 30 minutes crawling around outside.
But,
and
you
get
know,
something
I,
just as
I
good.
Work I work with
it's
these guys.
More fun, too.
It's way more fun than standing there.
I work with these guys now. I mean, that's who my clients are now, right? My clients are serial entrepreneurs, C-level executives. These are the people who call me and want to be like my private client that I work with for, I do an annual program. They're 30, 40 pounds overweight. They traded their health for wealth 20, 30 years. They just sold their company for $200 million. They don't give a shit about money, right?
Right.
Money doesn't motivate them at all anymore. They don't care how much my program costs. And if I tell them to go buy a $5,000 vibroplate, they're fine. What they care about is time, right? Mm-hmm. They care about their time. And so you go, you can do this vibroplate for 5 minutes, or you can go outside and exercise. And like most of the people we know would be like, yeah, I'm going to freaking go out and, like, you know, walk through the trees or go surfing or, like, you know, have some fun while I'm getting my movement in. But the person who's still grinding, the entrepreneurial acts, you know, like trying to get in there and make their mark, they'd rather do the vibroplate, man.
Yeah. No, totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
that's actually a really interesting perspective that I hadn't fully considered until you said it just now, where actually some of that's making a little more sense at the moment.
Yeah.
Well, Doug's being blown away right now.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, there's a real rationale for doing that.
It wasn't a terrible idea to bring me on after all. I know you guys were regretting it when I first got here. I could see, like, the look in your eyes, like, going, oh, shit, what are we going to talk to this guy about?
I'm all about
trying to, like, find each little thing. Like if the vibration plate was not so expensive, I would probably throw in the corner for like warm ups and cool downs, and it would be awesome for that. There's obviously benefits to it, but it is funny when somebody's not moving at all,
right?
And that they're relying specifically on that,
right?
Or what do you think about the glasses?
The blue blocking glasses.
Well, you have blue blocking glasses, and now they have these glasses that like shoot lasers into your eyes or something.
Yeah. to do light therapy.
Yeah.
The retimer, right?
It's like when you put these glasses on, it shines light in your eyes. I'm going. It's like
you
it's
could
like,
use
I'm
that,
like,
but
I'm like, this doesn't seem like the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, the right time to use those things is when you have a circadian shift, right? As most people know, this body is somewhere around 200,000 years old. There's been zero upgrades, right? Like, it would be the same as whatever, a 1980 Honda Civic being exactly the same today, right? There's been zero upgrades whatsoever. We didn't evolve in a world where we could cross 12 time zones in a day. Just didn't happen. Mm. So how the hell would we have any mechanism for fixing that? We don't. Like, we have this very slow mechanism that takes days.
I've noticed.
Like, you cross one time zone, and you're heading east. You cross one time zone. It's at least a day before your body can capture that. But how long would it have taken you to walk across a time zone? multiple days, right? Mm-hmm. So it was never a problem until the last 100 years or something.
Yeah.
So things like retimers and, you know, that put the light in your eyes, or even totally different mechanism, but similar idea, the human charger where they put the light in your ears. Have you seen that?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, things like light therapy to, you know, what light therapy does is it pushes your bedtime away. And then you can do things that pull your bedtime. I'm sorry, light therapy in the morning pulls your bedtime towards you. Light therapy late in the day will push your bedtime away. Or exercise late in the day will push your bedtime further away. Mm-hmm. You know, so depending on where you've traveled and when you need to sleep and when you like want to be at your optimal, you can put little tricks in. Again, this is like, here's ideal. Don't travel. Okay. Here's reality. I travel.
Yep.
All right. So how do I bridge that gap? All right. Well, first, you know, we do some stuff over here to kind of preload and get you ready to travel. And then once you travel, like in order to get back to that area, to get back to that ideal, there's little biohacks. <You know? laughs> I hate that term because like I think the original biohackers were the pharmaceutical industry, right? And they're just like, we'll make a molecule that like your molecule, but it'll work better, right?
And yeah, that's
kind of where biohacking is in some respects to me, right? And like obviously we know that the movement therapy would have way more benefits than the vibroplate, but if the vibroplate is all we can do, all right, let's do that.
Yep.
Or if you can get like 25% or 50% of the movement you need and we add the vibroplate in. Okay, great, right? These are all realistic things.
So the light therapy would be, that would be beneficial if I'm flying to Europe.
Yeah, if you're, now if you're, I'm gonna... you're changing time zones, or even if you're a shift worker, or if you know that you're going to have to stay up late, you know, for, say you're doing an event or something, you know that event's going to go to like 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and you're normally in bed by 9 p.m., you're going to be freaking wiped at, you know, midnight trying to be on stage running an event or something. So you do things to push your bedtime further away. Like, you know, that's kind of what those things are about. And you know, and that's what, you know, melatonin is about. And that's what, you know, the heart rate variability training and, you know, bringing your stress levels down, bringing your stress hormones down, all of that type of stuff, light therapy, all of the sleep hygiene stuff, you know, sleep hygiene is really two things. It's how much light's going into your eyes and how stimulated you are. It's really all it is. If you Google sleep hygiene, you'll find 5 million pages with 300,000 different things on it. But if you just explain to somebody, here's the concept of sleep hygiene, it's really simple. Decrease the amount of blue light going into your eyes about 3 hours before you want to go to bed. Try to eliminate it completely if you can.
This is turning off your electronics.
Yeah.
TV.
Or just monitors. Wearing like gaming glasses or shooting glasses that block blue light.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I do. I put on these glasses at home at 7 o'clock every night. They have these little titanium rims. They're frameless. Don't even know I had them on. They hardly have any tint to them at all. They're slightly yellowish, but they block blue light. It would be the same as me living out without electricity, because now I can have the lights in my house going and I can have my television on, I can use my computer. But the other part of that sleep hygiene is how stimulated you are. Because what happened ancestrally, again, this 200,000-year-old body, when the sun went down, there wasn't a hell of a lot to do because you couldn't see very far, right? It was kind of dangerous to be running around at night. And so people weren't super stimulated. They didn't have rave parties. They didn't have loud music and freaking strobe lights.
I don't know.
You know, so they didn't have all this stuff going on. So they just, like, we never developed sort of any mechanism for handling that. And again, just that's probably only in the last 50 years that we've really started. Well, probably post-industrialization when time became money and people wanted to be able to work in a factory all through the night or something like that. That's kind of when all that started happening to us.
So what is it about blue light? Like, why isn't it just light?
Well, because, my guess, pure speculation is that it's because the sky is blue, and that would be a really smart cue if we were trying to figure out when the sun went down, right? Mm. Because we've had fire for a long time, right? So you still would have gotten light without electricity. Mm. But you have some ganglion in the back of your eyes, and even a lot of blind people have these ganglion. Have nothing to, and ganglion just means like a cluster of nerves stuck together, right? So you have all these nerves stuck together, neurons stuck together, and they're in the back of your eye, and they sense blue light. That's all they do. And when the blue light goes down, they start this pathway that goes down through something called the master clock, or the suprachiasmatic nucleus. A lot of people have heard the master clock phrase. Really long circuitous route, and eventually hits something called the pineal gland, which secretes melatonin. Melatonin does tons of changes in your brain, but it also decreases stress hormones and your sensitivity to stress hormones, which starts winding you down, getting you ready for sleep. your brain, the SCN or the master clock, also changes a lot of the neurochemistry of your brain, and it starts slowing down certain brain regions and decreasing your interaction with the environment. One of the main neuropeptides for that is something called GABA, which you've probably seen in health food sort of, right? Mm-hmm. Gamma-aminobutyric acid. And what that does is it lowers the resting potential of a neuron, right? So a neuron's like a battery. It's ready to fire. The lower the resting potential is, the harder it is to fire that neuron. So it lowers that resting potential, makes it harder for those neurons to fire, which means you don't move as much. You don't feel as much. You don't hear as much. Like, and we've all had that pre-sleep phase or post-sleep phase where you wake up, you're really in stage one sleep, where it's still a form of sleep, but you're aware of your environment, but not really, right? Like, you know what's going on, but you're not really interacting. And
when I get up in the middle of the night to pee.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like...
Yeah. And it can kind of blend with your dreams or mm-hmm. thoughts you were having during your sleep. And it's not, you're not quite all there. That's what's supposed to happen. And that's what ordinarily happens if you just take away light and you take away stimulation. So if you take away light and then you go, I'm going to go to bed at 10 o'clock. And then you get on your computer and you freaking grind on your business, or your PowerPoint presentation or whatever the hell you're going to do. And you work till 9:59 and go get in bed. Guess what's going to happen? You're not going to sleep, man, because yeah. you've kept your brain awake. You know, happy hour is a great example of that. When, you know, probably all three of us have had, you know, schlep jobs where we 9 to 5 kind of time clock kind of job, and you wake up some mornings, you're like, I'm so exhausted, I'm going back to sleep as soon as I get home from work. Like, as soon as work's right. over, I'm coming home and getting in bed. And your friend's talking to go on the happy hour. Mm-hmm. You have a couple of beers, which should make you more tired. And what happens? Wide awake, man. And that's because you've overcome that GABAergic system that's slowing down your brain. You've just wiped it out, overpowered it by wake-promoting neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. You're seeing members of the opposite sex around, assuming you're heterosexual. I'm not judging anybody. whatever. You're talking to your buddies. You know, there's loud music around. There's lights. There's televisions. Whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's all sleep hygiene. It's those two things. With that knowledge, you can figure out anything on your own, right? You can take your own lifestyle and go, oh, I have to get the light out of my eyes, blue light out of my eyes 3 hours before bedtime, and I have to decrease my interaction with the environment an hour or two before bedtime.
Yeah, right? I kind of set my house up that way, which is, well, I get a lot.
Yeah, I can see all the skylights and the.
I get a lot of natural light, but when the sun starts going down, I don't blast
right.
my whole house with light. As soon as the sun goes down, I use just enough light to get there, and none of it's...
It's actually good for the health of your eyes as well, like to keep your focal length, right? It's to operate in a dim light environment as well, so...
Yeah, and we have rules around, like, we just try no electronics after 8,
because
we want to be in bed and asleep by 10.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super easy.
Yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science, man.
Yeah.
It's not rocket surgery, even.
So, regarding alcohol... I noticed that I don't drink very much anymore, but when I used to drink a lot, if I went to bed even 2 o'clock in the morning, I still wake up at like 6, 7 in the morning, like 3, 4, 5 hours of sleep, and I'm like wide awake.
Yeah.
Well, why is that? Do you know?
Yeah. So alcohol is actually processed in a couple of different systems, but one of the main systems is through your liver. Alcohol dehydrogenase shifts alcohol essentially to formaldehyde, what we embalm people with. That floats around in your bloodstream as a toxin. You have your immune system, right? Your immune system fights off bacteria, parasites, viruses, pretty much, and repairs damaged tissues, damaged cells. Your adrenals are really designed to help defend you from what's outside of your environment, right? Guys with machine guns or tigers or snakes, whatever, like that's your immune system for what's outside of your body. That's your stress hormone system. When you're poisoned, your adrenals go, let's ramp this shit up and metabolize all this and get it all out. So you
process all that.
Yeah, so you poison yourself, and then your body, converts all that. Well, you drink alcohol, your body converts all that to a poison while you're asleep. You also pretty much destroy deep sleep, which is where all your anabolic hormones are produced.
I track my sleep every night, and I basically track what I did that day, and alcohol is on that.
Yeah.
And I deal, and I don't drink a lot, but every once in a while, I have a couple scotches, say on a Friday night, and I definitely notice that my sleep's just not. It's yeah. more disrupted.
Yeah.
Every time.
And it does other things. I mean, it dehydrates you. It has some neurological activity, especially with the frontal lobe. But it does. It definitely causes an increase of stress hormones. Now, for all of us, like for men who are relatively fit and have a reasonable amount of muscle mass, we produce a lot of a molecule called adenosine, which is the breakdown of ATP, right? ATP, ADP, AMP, and then just A, and the A is adenosine. That causes sleep pressure. That's what makes us feel like going to sleep. When you drink alcohol, you run a bunch of redundant cycles that produces a lot of ATP and produces a lot of adenosine, so it makes you more tired as well. But if you have a reasonable amount of muscle mass and you're fairly active, or even if you just use your brain really intensely, your brain can produce, there's astrocytes in your brain produce adenosine as well, and that actually makes your brain feel sleepy. Like it increases all those sleep-promoting neurochemicals I was talking about earlier. Along with the GABAergic system, there's other things that kind of slow down those neurons and make you want to go to sleep. So men can usually go to sleep kind of during under any circumstance because they have so much adenosine. Now, a woman who is maybe the same height, right, or, you know, they have less muscle mass for about the same size brain, right? Like a 5'6" man and a 5'6" woman, brain size maybe 10% difference. How much muscle mass is different? You know, could be 300% different, right?
Yeah.
So they're not producing as much adenosine. So women oftentimes have problems going to sleep. But men usually crash out from a lot of sleep pressure. As soon as their brain flushes all those neurotoxins out, their stress hormones are there, especially if they poison themselves with alcohol. Stress hormones actually ramp up and they wake up. They feel like shit, right?
Yeah.
Because they didn't get any real sleep. If you did what we call a polysomnograph, where we put all the electrodes on your head and we looked at your brain waves, we should be able to see like certain brain waves or in clusters and synchronicity that we expect to see, like certain waves going through your brain when you sleep. And that's how we define the stages of sleep. You know, these things like sleep watches, you know, the actigraphy, it's an approximation of that. But, you know, the concept is that we should see these kind of patterns going around your brain, and we can say you're in stage one, you're in stage two, stage three, stage four sleep. You were in that for that long. You came back up, you did REM sleep, you came back down, whatever. When you put drugs in there, all that gets destroyed. All right. And that can be an over the counter sleep drug. It can be a prescription sleep drug. It could be alcohol, like whatever.
So if you take something like not alcohol, not like you got blacked out drunk and then you passed out, which I think if you get on the show, last time you were on the show, you made the point that you're less sleeping and you're more just unconscious, and you made
right.
that comparison.
Right.
So if you take something more normal, like you take a Benadryl or something like that, and a lot of people, I know that they can't sleep and they take a Benadryl and they go to sleep. Like, how does that really affect their sleep waves and the quality of their sleep?
Yeah, so if you do, you know, the sort of stage one, stage two, three, and four in a predictable pattern that for predictable time frames, and not everybody's exact, right? I mean, think of it like personal training. Like it's, you know, programming isn't exact, but, you know, approximate your sleep architecture, that's what we call that. Your sleep architecture looks good. All sleep drugs distort the sleep architecture. Some are more impactful in the REM sleep, which is where your brain's actually recovering, where you're actually making things that you learned that day, putting them into durable memories, or being able to compare that to other stuff that you already know and work with it and form like creative ideas. All that's happening during REM sleep. Even muscle memory stuff, right? So if you screw with REM sleep, which sleep drugs are, like prescription sleep drugs, totally destroy REM sleep. You get like 20% of the REM sleep. You essentially just don't learn as fast and you don't form memories as fast. And that leads to a lot of the PTSD type symptoms as well, because one of the things you're doing during REM is you're emotionally categorizing an event. So if you have a fight with your wife over something totally stupid, like leaving your socks on the floor or something.
Never happened.
Classic. Yeah. Well, you don't wear socks, but I'm talking about the Midwest again.
She shouldn't leave them on the floor.
So if you have an argument like that, that should be in nothing, right? Like you might get really heated and be super pissed off, and 10 minutes later, you're like, that was stupid. But if you don't sleep that night, the next day that will be like a raw nerve, man, and it would be so much easier to flip out on your wife over anything, right? You'll be like so much ready. But if you go to sleep that night, you go, okay, dying of, you know, dysentery, you know, get my car stolen. Like, you just keep going and like, oh, wow, the socks on the floor are like way down there, right? At the floor, ironically. So
still on the floor, where they should be.
Where they should be. What the hell are you going to do? Put the socks on the ceiling? Makes no sense. yeah, I mean, so you, if you don't emotionally categorize events, then those things turn out to be more stressful and easier to react, and you react more emotionally to them. And then the more bad sleep you get, the more that gets reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. Mm. And we know that there's a huge correlation actually between any type of psychological disease. Like you talk about depression, bipolar, you know, mania, psychosis, anything you've ever heard of, we know is heavily associated with sleep. There's a branch of medicine now called chronobiology and chronotherapy, where they're using things like the light therapy we were talking about to help people realign their circadian rhythm. And there's a pretty good chance that we're going to find out that every single depressed person who's ever been depressed, that depression was preceded by a poor period of sleep. And if you remove that poor period of sleep, would it relieve the depression? Would they ever get depressed? We don't know the answer to that. But it's looking pretty promising that that's it. And then it increases your risk for psychotic breaks, which is, you know, the reason for something like, you know, the military doing the sleep deprivation during boot camp, getting you up super early. They're actually trying to break people. They're trying to see who's going to break. Then you get in higher level, you go to SEAL training, you go for a week without sleep. They're trying to see who's going to have a psychotic break. They're trying to see who's going to flip out, who can't handle, you know, operations and that. And guess what? That's genetic. And you, like, you could be a great dude, but it's just not going to work out for you if, you know, if your brain can't handle that. And that's, you know, well, it's genetic, it's environmental, you know, there's some other issues involved, but, you know, it, not everybody has the same tolerance for anything, right? None of us have the same stress tolerance, the same exercise tolerance, the same sleep deprivation tolerance, or even the same nutritional tolerance, right? Like some, like we all knew the dude is like six pack abs, he eats McDonald's every day. And like, how the hell do you do that? You know, it's like, you know,
it happens.
Probably this guy. That's right. I'm not that you would eat McDonald's, but you know,
he loves McDonald's.
I think you could eat whatever you want to. Probably not. I stay ripped.
I got away with a lot for a while.
Yeah.
The physique hasn't changed. Like the look hasn't changed. How I feel. There's a difference. With
right.
That.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So earlier we were talking about how sleep affects nutrition, nutrition affects sleep. It's all interconnected and intertwined in a million ways. And you had mentioned you know, vitamin D3, magnesium. You mentioned melatonin at one point. You know, do any of these things specifically increase the amount of REM sleep someone would get?
Sort of all of those things do. What we find in the sleep literature really is that if you initiate sleep properly, it probably keeps going. Like there's a really good chance it's gonna come out looking just fine if you kind of set everything up. Mm-hmm. So for example, like the supplement that I sell is an initiator. It's an initiator. That's all it is. Like everything in there is out of your bloodstream within a few hours. Mm. But a lot of people come and go, man, I slept 12 hours on this stuff and I haven't slept more than 6 hours ever, like since it's 20. I'm like, well, that didn't make you sleep 12 hours because nothing in there lasts 12 hours, but they initiated the cascade really well and their brain kind of kept going down the pathway that it should do. So, I mean, really just having solid nutrition affects that. Having solid stress control affects that. Having appropriate levels of movement and exercise affects that. You know, everything affects everything. You know, I tell people we learned, you know, as doctors, all healthcare providers, if you want to call it that, I don't think doctors, again, are healthcare providers or disease care providers. But we all learn the body in systems. There's a neurological system, right? There's a nervous system. There's a cardiovascular system. There's a pulmonary system. There's a musculoskeletal system. It's all bullshit, right? Like there are no systems. We figured out a way to break it into learnable chunks, right? Things that seem to be associated. That was a clever way to learn it. But it's not how you should think about it afterwards, right? Yeah. That's why your neurologist doesn't know anything about cardiology and your cardiologist doesn't know anything about your brain, right? Unless it's directly affecting cardiology, which is, you know, everybody gets more and more and more specialized as information grows and grows and grows. You just become more and more screwed because, you know, now this guy's like, you know, you go see a specialist who only does one type of surgery on females less than 36 years old and only in the left eye on Tuesdays. And like, that's how specialized this guy is, right? But health has to be thought of as holistically, right? And even though I say sleep, nutrition, exercise, and stress, all those things are the same, right? They're all so completely intertwined. It's a way for me to help teach you how to think about it and to help coach you so that we can say, you know, sleep is a big component, but does your nutrition affect your sleep? Hell yeah. Does your sleep affect your appetite? Hell yeah. So that therefore affects your sleep, right? Or affects your nutrition the next day, right? You get poor sleep, hormonal changes, appetite regulation changes. What you want to eat is different that day than if you would have got a good night's sleep. Mm. Does exercise affect your sleep? Of course. Does sleep affect your exercise? Of course, right? Same thing with stress. You want to stress somebody out, take away their sleep. Nothing will increase stress hormones faster than sleep deprivation. That's why we use it as a tool to break people down. Like, there's a reason we use it for interrogation. Nothing breaks you faster than sleep deprivation, but we're not affecting your nutrition or your exercise status. We're affecting your ability to handle stress. And to be stress resilient, you have to not only do things to train yourself to be stress resilient, like meditation or mindfulness training or, you know, whatever, introspection through plant medicine or heart rate variability training or, you know, breathing exercises, whatever it is that you do, or even exercise, right? Like sort of repetitive exercises like swimming and distance running, those things can be sort of meditative, and those all can affect your stress levels, and they make you more, they inoculate you against stress so that when you do have a stressor, like a car wreck or a big fight with your spouse or sleep deprivation, it affects you less. But you take away your sleep, you can't, you're like, your stress mitigation ability is lowered. But if you're stressed out all day, how well do you sleep? Mm-hmm. Right? You sleep like crap when you're stressed, and your stress hormones actually wake you up, which then makes you more stressed. And now you're sleep deprived, so that's affecting your nutrition, right? And actually not even what you eat, but it affects your gut biome, like within 6-7 hours, it affects your gut biome and your ability to absorb and break down what you eat and actually get the nutrients out of that. Exercise, something like exercise, a single bout of exercises changes how many glucose, the GLUT4 receptors that are actually bring glucose into the cell. Mm. There's all sorts of cellular membrane transporters that are affected with one bout of exercise. So you don't exercise one day, you're physiologically different the next day. Mm-hmm. And when I use the word exercise, I don't mean, you know, you have to go run a marathon or do a CrossFit workout or whatever. I just mean really activity in proportion to whatever your your physiologic or physical goals are.
The stress piece is interesting to me because, like we were saying, like when someone's in a stressful situation, they tend not to, you know, that's when they might go eat something they shouldn't eat. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to have a drink. Or fuck it. I'm going to eat a hamburger instead of, you know, whatever. Something that doesn't include so much bread or whatever. Eat a bowl of cereal.
Yeah.
What, you know, they start making poor decisions around that.
It's very simple science as to why that happens.
Back when I let stress impact me more, I had a hard time sleeping.
Right.
Like, I lay in bed and I think about all the stuff that needs mm-hmm. to get done or what happened earlier that day or what I have to do tomorrow.
And you also worry about shit that you have no control over, but
mostly
you're just like, I'm going to worry about it anyways mostly. Because it's really bothering me. Even though I can't do anything about it, I'm going to lay here for 2 hours and worry about it.
Yeah. In my personal experience and the people I've worked with is if we can disrupt the sleep or disrupt the stress, then everything else starts falling in line. So the stress, you know, even if lack of sleep or bad nutrition or whatever, no matter what the cause of the stress is initially, or emotional stress is commonly the culprit, you know, we figure out a way to disrupt that stress. Now people start sleeping better, eating better. All of a sudden, all the things they've been working on, it's like, oh, I've been exercising and I've been eating right and I still can't, you know, achieve the level of health I've been looking to get because I still have this stress that's disrupting my sleep. And even if I'm like, I have the willpower to accomplish these other things, it's still completely jacking me up.
Right.
So what are your favorite ways of, I guess, disrupting stress cycles?
So, I mean, and you could make that same argument about any of the pillars, right?
Yeah.
Once I get you to eat a good diet for 30 days, are you going to sleep better?
Yeah, I've also heard that.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And like the same thing with exercise. Like I get you to be active. Like you're completely inactive person, I get you to be active.
Right.
Does that affect your stress levels? Of course. Does it affect your sleep? Of course. Does it affect your food choices? Of course. But stress, like stress mitigation, I really listen to the person's language. I figure out what their priorities are. You know, some people are really religious. Some people are really spiritual. Some people are, you know, sort of really into, you know, the more esoteric kind of mindfulness stuff. And they really want to go down that rabbit hole to try to, you know, get introspection as to what their trigger is for stress and learn how to control that. And, you know, like, as I mentioned earlier, there's, you know, there's plant medicines and all sorts of ceremonies and things that can help people do that. And even pharmaceuticals that help people do that. So if that's your bag, okay, let's figure out a plan to do that. If you're a really gadget oriented guy, you know, like I have people who sleep on the, you know, have like the grounding mat on their mattress. Like, do I think that works? No. But if they think it works and it matters to them, cool. Right. I don't really care. Like my goal is to get you to sleep better or, you know, control your stress better. You know, so some people do the heart rate variability training, right? They get a little device, they put an EKG on, and then that tells you like your autonomics, as we were talking about, your stress hormones are part of your autonomics, and they drive the sympathetic tone, which is the fight or flight pathway, which impairs your prefrontal cortex, your decision-making ability and your motivation and your willpower and your ability to make right smart choices and predict what, if you do this now, what does it mean for the future me if I do this now? All that kind of goes away the more stressed you get because it impairs your prefrontal cortex. Sleep deprivation also impairs your prefrontal cortex, and primarily because of the same reason, the stress hormones. If you look at the symptoms of ADHD and you look at the symptoms of sleep deprivation, they're identical. They're identical for a reason because it's doing the same thing to your brain. So the stress is really about decreasing the stress hormones in your prefrontal cortex and allowing this big part of our brain, like this part is kind of like, you know, from our temples above our eyes, mm-hmm. all that forehead area, that's the prefrontal cortex. That's what makes us the smartest animal on the planet.
That's kind of what makes us human.
Yeah.
Versus there's other animals that have prefrontal cortex, but it's a smaller percentage of the brain.
Right. It's not as well developed.
Right.
And so as far as we know, no other animal on the planet has the sense of self-awareness to plan for its future. Or to
right.
think about the consequences of this action, other than like getting eaten by another animal if they come out of a, you know, cave or something. Yeah. Obviously, but you know, like they're not thinking about, you know, their retirement plan, or, you know, or how many kids they should have or anything like that. Like life's just happening to them.
Some would say that's not a good thing.
Yeah,
like, the fact that we're that concerned about
right.
something that's probably not going to happen,
but
like retirement.
Anthony Sapolsky, or Sapolsky, however you say his name, he's a researcher at Stanford. He wrote the book Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, mm-hmm. and he calls this our simulator, which I think is a perfect metaphor
yeah.
for it. It's just like a flight simulator, right? So mm-hmm. you get a pilot gets in a flight simulator, you can throw crap at them and they can crash, no harm, no foul, right? Because they figured it out in the simulator. Okay, I won't do that next time. They practice, won't do that. We can do the same thing with our prefrontal cortex. When you look at the matrix, decision matrix for anything, like how you're going to run your business, what are you going to do in your relationship, like how you're going to, you know, what choices are you going to make around finances, what choices you're going to make around your nutrition, how you, like wherever, like all of that stuff, we can use our simulator to figure out what's the best choice. We're not always right. Of course, we suck at being right. Like we're not good at predicting the future, but like the immediate future, we can predict pretty well. So, like,
a lot of people would say that the issue is the simulator's fairly new.
Yeah.
And over the last, say...
But it's still a couple hundred thousand years old.
Yeah, but I would say over the last few hundred years, there's been this overemphasis of developing the simulator, or overdeveloping it and in such a way that we now associate that as who we are.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, that's where the ego, you know, that's where the ego is primarily located in our presentation. Right. And that's where a lot of our self-judgment comes from, right? Because, you know, we notice patterns. That's what this whole thing is about, is noticing patterns. You know, a lot of what people call, you know, racism isn't racism. And like, there's no negative association with it. It's just like, I've noticed this pattern about, you know, people who dress this way or behave this way. Like, they tend to be more dangerous than people who don't dress that way. So, like, I'm going to stay away from them. Oh, that's racist. No, that's a pattern, right? You're just recognizing a pattern. You recognize a pattern of, you know, drinking whiskey every night before you go to bed and you don't sleep as well. That's a pattern that you recognize. So your simulator can go, I wonder if I don't drink alcohol tonight, what would happen? And then you can observe the results of that. But if your simulator is broken, you don't even have that level of introspection.
I would say a lot of people, the simulator's broken.
It is.
And
it is. And just being stressed breaks the simulator, which is the crazy thing about it. But if you think about fight or flight, right? The stress hormones, adrenal hormones, adrenals hormones secrete adrenaline, right? You get in fight or flight, all sorts of things happen, right? You really become sort of superhuman physiologically, right? Your pain threshold goes way up, your reflexes increase, you mobilize all your glycogen stores to your limbs so that you can exercise longer, you have more strength, your respiratory system opens up so that you can take in more air, your heart rate goes up, you put more blood pressure to all sorts of regions, you know, your pupils dilate to take in more light, to focus on whatever the danger is, and then you fight, flee, or freeze, and you try to get out of that situation. If you don't get out of that situation, doesn't matter. So nothing else matters. You actually want to be really impulsive during that. You don't want to plan it out systematically.
Right.
So if you try to plan it out systematically, you're going to screw it up. You're going to be dinner, right? And so it actually shuts your prefrontal cortex off to be in pure fight or flight.
Turns you into an animal.
Right. If you're in pure fight or flight, if you're in a gunfight and I came up next to you and said, hey, Mike, what do you think about adding this supplement to the site? You'd probably shoot me, right? You'd be like,
definitely.
Like, get the hell out of here. Like, right? Or even if I said, what's your phone number? Or, anything sort of human cerebral is gone. It's out the window. That's fight or flight.
Yep.
So if we say fight or flight is here, adrenal-wise, and deep sleep is exactly the opposite. You have almost no adrenal hormones when you're in deep sleep. That's when you're the most anabolic. This is the most catabolic. You're actually using your body as a fuel to get your body away from danger, right? So you're using your muscles, your glycogen store, like you're breaking yourself down to be able to get away from that. Deep sleep, you're repairing everything. Fight or flight's here, deep sleep's here. We should live around here, but in our information age, LA traffic, assholes on social media, like all of this crap that comes in our lives, and we're just constantly needled and prodded, and demand, reaction. I mean, 300 years ago, how reactive was anybody? Right. I mean, just think about, like,
so you're saying this is probably a new phenomenon,
yeah,
and we haven't figured out how to fix it yet,
which is why everybody's striving for all these different stress control techniques, right? And that's why all these gadgets are coming out, and that's why there's a whole renewed interest in 2,000-3,000 year old medicine, products that are allowing people to be more introspective and spiritual and connect with the world and not feel like, they're so egocentric and that it's not about them, and, kind of let go of all that, all of the bullshit that's crowding that space, allow you to be more open and be more you. I mean, there's a reason that movement's there. That's not, just, freaking hippies, and whatever Burning Man kind of guys. That's like everybody, right? We're talking Fortune 500 CEOs are doing that shit now.
Yeah.
Like serial entrepreneurs. And there's a reason for that. We know that stress is killing us. We don't want to admit it, though.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm actually doing a course. I got the book right over there, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself by Dr. Joe Dispenza. And I'm like in one of his courses, and one of the things he talks about is, you have you're learning things in your conscious mind, and then you eventually it becomes an unconscious learning, something that just happens automatically. And if you're over the age of 35, then 95% of what you do is unconscious.
Sure.
It's just automatic behavior.
Sure.
And then if you're wanting to change any behaviors, you've got 5% of your mind fighting 95% to change a habit or behavior, whatever you want to call
right.
it. And so, and a big part of that is, that's how much that 5% is prefrontal cortex. And now you're trying to use your prefrontal cortex to override the animal brain. And
right.
So, one of the primary thing that he uses and his method is meditation. And the meditation is learning how to shut down, like really light up the prefrontal cortex and shut down everything else. and even shut down the body. And so everything else slows down, and then you can bring all these things. And one of the things he talks about, too, is how a lot of information is stored in the body, not even necessarily in the brain.
Right.
Like a lot of the automatic behaviors, which we a lot of automatic behaviors we want to build in.
Right.
So like you were talking about, if you're in a firefight, like being able to be in a gunfight, there's a lot of things that you train over a period of time. So it is unconscious behavior. So it just happens.
Right.
So you don't have to like, oh, I need to go shoot this guy.
But
now.
even just physical intelligence, you know, in a non-trained environment, like, you know, the reason a horse is such a smart animal is because they have so much neuronal tissue, like in their fascial layers. Mm-hmm. And that's how they can walk over a log, right? They're going down a trail. Their eyes are out here, right? Like, how the hell do they know where that thing is with their feet,
yeah.
right? And like, how do they recognize faces in humans when they have like proportionally this ridiculously small brain? But if you look at the overall neurological tissue in their body, and of course we have like 10% of our neuronal, you know, capacity is actually in our gut, you know, the gut brain, but they have this like all throughout their bodies, and that's what makes them so smart. But keep going with your stuff.
Yeah. So the idea is, the way I've understood and I understand now is disrupting that stress a lot of times is we're living in that, we're not really living, like you were saying, we're not in that prefrontal cortex. We're just kind of operating back here, and we have just a small bit of consciousness awake trying to operate things, but fighting this animal that's just way too powerful.
Right.
And so the idea is to do practices, use methods to like basically turn on prefrontal cortex as much as possible and shut everything else down. So he uses meditation, but I've also seen like with plant medicines, they've shown that a lot of the blood, like a lot of times they were thinking blood flow in the brain was being increased overall. And when they end up finding out is it's being concentrated.
Right.
And so it is shutting down everything
and
else.
Glucose utilization through PET scans and stuff. They're doing a pretty good job of like functionally seeing what happens in your brain now. And this is only like literally within the last 15 years, we've been looking at people's brains when they meditate or when we put them under stress, and we can say, oh, that's happening. Like we've, you know, most of biology, you know, in the history of biology is descriptive. We've known for a long time that there's this thing called the amygdala in your brain. We had some idea, kind of, like I think it's associated with kind of these types of thoughts or behaviors. And then it turns out, oh, that's actually like the full alarm system. Like that's really kind of the trigger for the whole fight or flight and the decision-making matrix and all this. We learned that through functional MRIs by putting people in stress and go, what areas of their brain? Well, it's these two walnuts like perfectly in everybody's brain. We go, oh, that makes a lot of sense. And now we can start mapping things out. But to the point of, you know, to the point of that book is, you know, every animal, every mammal, well, not even mammal, but like I think every vertebrae on this planet has what we call the lizard brain, which is all of that stuff, the subcortical mass. So we have like the big wrinkly part of our brain, which everybody thinks of as the human brain. You pull that part off, which is, by the way, what sleep drugs do is they just dissociate your lizard brain from all that. Your lizard brain is controlling all your automatic behaviors, right? But also, like,
what is going on?
But it's also controlling sort of the automatic triggers. The interesting thing about the lizard brain is that it can handle and process like millions of bits of information simultaneously. Your prefrontal cortex can do like 10 or, you know, like a few things, like 10, 20 things you can process and kind of be aware of. Like right now, until I say it, you aren't really aware of how your feet feel on the ground.
But
now you are, right? But you weren't before, or, you know, and we're just blocking all that information out because our cortex can't handle all of that information. So the whole idea of getting rid of the human experience and just like this whole idea of like universal oneness and like blend and just realizing that we're all part of the same shit really means that we're just admitting that we're just like everything else on this planet. And that's the part of us that we need to optimize because that can handle so much. Then we only need this prefrontal cortex to do like three things. And then it's doing what it should. And then we're not as tired and we're not as stressed. We can work, you know, longer, we're happier with our lives, like all that type of stuff, you know. And meditation is one way of sort of trying to control that, which is it's a great practice, but it's also a very difficult practice to get really good at. And there's benefits immediately, but to be outstanding at it and, you know, to be like a Tibetan monk takes decades to get that way, which is why a lot of the medications are coming on board to kind of help do that and these little biofeedback type devices and so forth.
I see like two different approaches. You have the a little bit every day approach,
right,
which is, you know, meditate 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever, and you'll get, you know, 0.01% better every day that you do it, and consistency. And people who meditate every day for 2 weeks notice a difference. You
know,
you're not going to notice a difference day one, but maybe by day 20, there's a difference. And then I'm actually going to a Vipassana retreat at the end of January, which is 10 days,
like
meditating 11 hours a day for 10 days in a row. And so then you have like the deep dive, or like when Doug and I, or you could talk about plant medicines too.
Right.
Like some people might take small doses of magic mushrooms every other day, or something like that. And then some people might do what Doug and I did, go to Peru and do like ayahuasca, like a really heavy dose.
A heroic dose
of it. And so I think there's benefits of both, where one is like the big dose, like a 10-day meditation or an ayahuasca retreat is you're going in and like reformatting a lot of what is stored in lizard brain.
Right.
And you're like, oh, we're going to clean house, change some things. And then you come out of that and all of a sudden all these things in your life change. It feels like automatic change. But you went back and you changed it in there, rewired some stuff, came out, and now things in your life start – you behave differently and everyone else around you seems like they're behaving differently.
Yeah, because that experience allowed you to be aware of that process. Right?
Exactly.
We aren't aware of our lizard brain. Like right now, our lizard brain is controlling my respiratory rate, my heart rate, my blood pressure, you know, my balance, well, that to some extent. Like all sorts of things are being controlled by that region of my brain. I'm not aware of whatsoever.
Yeah.
But also a lot of my emotional triggers and a lot of my decision-making processes, a lot of my habits, like, you know, procrastination, that's coming from the lizard brain. That's not coming from the cortex, right?
Right.
But once you see it, now you have a choice over it. And that's what all the stuff is about, is like giving you the opportunity to pull back and see yourself from a third party perspective and go, oh, look at Mike running his whatever depression pattern. Like what leads to me doing depression? Well, it's, you know, I think of this and then I think of that and then this happens. And then I end up in this like lower mood state. But if you don't realize how you're getting there, then it's just something that happens to you.
You're just in it.
Yeah, you're just in it. It's like a fish in the water. Like a fish doesn't know it's in the water until you take it out of the water, and then it sure as hell recognizes that it was in the water. It's like, oh, wow, I was surrounded by all this shit I never saw before. Right. And that's what all these things are doing, what the meditation is doing. You know, even some of these little devices that are helping people, you know, sort of like biofeedback and neurofeedback, are helping people kind of get the right brain state similar to what you get in meditative states. You know, those things are helping. The plant medicines are helping. You know, there's... You know, supplements out there. Even that, I'm not sure they're technically supplements, but you know, they're being sold as supplements that, you know, can help you with these types of things as well. And of course, everything matters. Again, nutrition matters and movement matters and all that stuff. But everything you can do to kind of, I guess, automate that. You know, if you think of that as like the CPU, right? Like you automate that computer to run the right patterns, and that's a shitty analogy because the brain's way more powerful than a computer. But anyways, you want to run like that, you know, that operating system as smooth as possible so that the cortex has to get involved as little as possible.
Yeah.
Right. Cause that's why our brains use like 25% of our fuel source. It's not because of our lizard brain. It's because of our big neocortex.
Yeah, if you could learn to, I guess if you could be more responsible or more, I guess, choosy about when you're turning, what you're using the prefrontal cortex for.
Right.
Are you using it to worry and have anxiety, or are you using it to change the behaviors and then learn how to get in that third person perspective, look in and rewire some things, go, oh, I see this. I can just change this right here. I just need to for a few days, I need to choose differently. Instead of eating this, I need to eat this. And then over time, it becomes an automatic behavior.
Yeah, the whole concept of habit formation is really that. But again, as you alluded to in the very beginning of that metaphor, is that if you don't realize you're doing it, if you don't know that you're using your prefrontal cortex to worry, you just say you're worried. Like, it's just something that's happening to me.
Right.
Like, I'm just stressed out today.
Right.
You're fucking making yourself stressed out. There's something that you are doing that is making you stressed. It's not the environment. It's your reaction to the environment, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing good or bad about the environment. We're meaning-making machines. We make it mean something bad, it's stressful.
Yep.
We make it mean something good, it's not stressful. It's good. You know, it's good for us, right?
Yeah.
And by and large, like, most of the time we're stressed, we're thinking about the future. And oftentimes we're thinking about the future shit we can't control. And most of the time we're depressed, we're looking at the past. We're thinking about shit that we have no control over anymore. So why wouldn't we be depressed? Because all this bad shit happened and we didn't want that to happen. Can't fix it now.
Yeah.
Fuck. So that's the point of the Zebras Don't Get Ulcers book, is that the zebra is purely present and experiencing. It's not thinking about the past. Yeah. So it's not depressed, not thinking about the future. So it doesn't have anxiety. It's not worried. It's just kind of chilling there where it is in that moment.
As far as we know, every animal on this planet is just purely doing, you know, purely doing the present moment, right? I mean, even a squirrel, you know, hiding nuts for the winter, it's like automatic behavior. Like, it's not something he's actually thinking about. Like, how many nuts do I need? You know, my body mass is this, and I want, you know, I want to keep my abs. And you know, like, they're
thinking. I saw a ripped squirrel once. Yeah, it was crazy.
But, you know,
he's on some shit.
Yes.
Is it one of the things that Dispenza talks about is basically the reptilian brain, or the body memory, or however you want to talk about that, is experiencing the past at all times.
Right.
And so everything is programmed from previous behavior.
Right.
And so
to recognize patterns.
Yeah. So you're in an automatic behavior, and it's based on the past.
Right.
None of it could potentially be based on the future.
Right.
At all.
Right.
So if you are relying only on the automatic behaviors, you're doomed to repeat the past. Exactly. So if you want your future to be different, you have to step out of, you actually have to engage with the prefrontal cortex.
Right.
You cannot, every situation will turn out the same forever. And that's why people find themselves in a rut, is because they can't use this part of their mind to imagine a future that is different. And that's where you have to go, okay, I want things to be different, and this is how. So I have to recognizing, one of the things he talked about is using, so you visualize the future and then also infuse a feeling of gratitude about the future that has not actually occurred yet. And
because
so,
because that makes it occur.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You infuse the emotional piece into that, and that's what allows the body, like if you have gratitude about the thing you're visualizing in the future, it changes the body memory or the reptilian brain. Without the gratitude piece, or without the emotional side along with the, because a lot of people talk about, oh, visualize success in the future, or visualize losing weight. But if you don't have the, if you don't tie in the emotional piece alongside that, it won't happen.
Then your neocortex is really telling you you're full of shit, right? Like, you can be 300 pounds overweight and stand in front of the mirror and go, I'm thin, I'm thin, I'm thin, I'm thin, I'm thin. And your body's going, bullshit, right? Your brain's like, no, you're not.
Yep.
But the words are coming out of your mouth, but you aren't feeling it.
Right.
Like, when you really, really start feeling that and start emoting it. But, you know, to your point, when you first started talking about that, you run all these patterns based on the past, which make you feel bad. Now you think about all of our veterans, and you think about TBI, you think about PTSD, right? So they're running patterns from the past that were shit, right? That not something they want. That's making them feel bad right now. What happens after they do that 100 times?
I mean,
this is the way it's always going to be. Like, why would you think anything else? You're 100% in the past at that point. You're like, this has never worked before.
The more you relive it, the harder that pattern gets ingrained.
Right. So you just have this, you have like this super highway bored into your brain that, you know, things are always going to suck. That's where the hopelessness comes from. That's where the suicidality comes from. And then you look at things that affect negatively the neurotransmitters and their ability to do all of the stuff that we're talking about. One, they don't have any training for it. Two, you know, the social structure sucks for it. Like, you've been in the military, you know how that is.
Yeah.
It's like counter that, right? You suck it up. You pull yourself up by the bootstraps. You fucking go, you get it done. And you don't whine, and you don't bitch, and you don't feel bad. You don't.
You
got
to talk to
yourself.
The chaplain, and the chaplain.
Yeah, your chaplain.
I was like,
chaplain says, suck it up, too. you know, but now you add in there, okay, let's damage our ability to do that. How about staying up all night playing video games, drinking Red Bull? Ding, right? There's one strike against you. How about a traumatic brain injury, right?
Yep.
What? How much does it take to get a traumatic brain injury? 1.02 Gs, right? The acceleration changes on a roller coaster ride damages your brain. What do you think the G-force is shooting a machine gun in a concrete room? 35 Gs.
Shit.
What do you think the G-force is inside of a Humvee with a 50 cal gun? 60 Gs. Carl Gustav round? 200-300 Gs, depending on where you're standing. Do we have any vets who don't, like combat vets who don't have TBI?
No.
We don't have a single one. You take somebody like Special Forces, just their training, they're getting 20 TBIs a day. Now you put them into combat on top of that, and you've totally fucked with their neurochemistry. They're also sleep depriving them. They're also feeding them shit food a lot of the times when they're deployed. They don't have options, right? They're forward deployed. Like, they're going to eat whatever you feed them. They don't have, it's not like they can bring all their food with them.
It's right? all about getting the calories.
Right.
It's all survival.
Right. And then now you live in a culture that doesn't allow you to feel bad, and it doesn't allow you to feel bad about yourself, and doesn't allow you to whine, and doesn't allow you to make any demands, and doesn't allow you even the time or encouragement to try to figure out what's going wrong in your schematics. It's just deny it, repress it, deny it, repress it, deny it, repress it. When the doctors ask you about it, when the psychologists ask you about it, when the chaplain, I'm fine, everything's good, because you don't want to lose your job.
Yeah.
And then when you get out of the military, what the hell happens? You have none of that culture anymore, right? And then you have all this brain injury that's affected your ability to relearn all of this stuff. You don't have any of the introspection. You come from a culture that, you know, sort of disavowed introspection. And now you're living, you know, wherever, back in Oklahoma or wherever you came from, with just your, you know, your old friends and your family, and none of them have the similar experiences to you. Like, how do you get yourself out of that rut, man? And then that's where, you know, I think that's where the PTSD is really happening. And I don't even really believe that PTSD is, you know, really a syndrome. I think that's kind of bullshit. I think it's just brain damage. Like, we've damaged brains and we've put bad experiences in people. And all of us have had traumatic shit happen in our lives.
You have a really traumatic emotional thing happen, and we have no tools to manage it.
You're not resilient yet anyways, because we set them up to be we set them up to be fragile instead of anti-fragile. Even though they're big, hulky, strong guys with body armor and beards, they're like, our culture sets them up for failure in this area. It's like, we don't give them tools to do this. No, I'm using that as a generalization, and lots of soft forces are starting to do mindfulness training and trying to bring things in like that. But, you know, that's why float chambers work, right?
Yeah.
That's why neurofeedback works. That's why NeuroIR works. That's why hyperbarics work. Like, all this stuff is repairing neurological damage. And then it's just essentially revving this machine up. If you think about TBI, you think about insomnia, you think about, you know, chronic stress, you think about PTSD, you're talking about the brain. And essentially you have a dysfunctioning organ, right? No different than if your heart's dysfunctioning. Can you use a dysfunctioning heart to fix a dysfunctioning heart? Hell no, right? It's broken. Like, you can't use something broken to fix something that's broken. Your brain is the broken part, and you're trying to use your own brain to fix it.
You're not going
to
will your way out of
this. You're not just going to, you know, suck it up. It doesn't happen. And that's just going to make you feel bad about it. Like you talked about earlier, you're going to run this pattern of failure after failure after failure, because you keep thinking, you keep running the pattern from the past. That just reinforces that pattern. And it just tells you, you know, you're 35 years old and you're like, I got 50 more years of this. That's when that's when they go start their pistol.
Yeah.
Isn't that one of the rationales for MDMA psychotherapy, where they may not help with the TBI specifically, but for things like PTSD, they can talk through these traumatic experiences and kind of repattern, or I don't know if that's the right term, but like, they can reassociate these negative experiences where they don't seem so negative anymore, because they were able to do some type of therapy in a safe environment where they go through the conversations and have that discussion, where at the end of it, they just feel differently about all the horrible things that they saw or experienced.
Yeah, they take their ego out of it. It takes their sense of self out of it, you know, and just like a lot of the plant medicines, you get the ego out of it, you get the sense of self out of it, and then all of a sudden you aren't the problem. And in fact, there is no problem. It's just a pattern. And once you see that pattern and you're like, oh, it's that pattern that's making me feel that way, because I saw and experienced this and I've processed it as meaning this, but it doesn't have to mean that. I can make it mean whatever I want it to mean. Now you have the ability. And then, you know, really with all of these types of interventions, it's the talking about the experience is where the benefit is, because you're actually processing things that you actually felt, right? Like you aren't consciously thinking, oh, I'm looking at myself from a third party, or from a third person perspective. You just are. You're just experiencing it. So you talk about what you experienced. You talk about your emotions. You talk about what you felt. And you talk about your revelations, which are happening at the speed of thought, which is a billion times faster than we can talk, right? Mm. So you process all of that stuff, and you, and you know, whether it's, you know, whether something like an MDA or MDMA.
MDMA?
Yeah, MDMA. There's a neurological receptor called NMDA, and I always get them confused. I told you I'm not very smart. but like all of these things that allow you to get rid of the ego, get rid of the sense of self, and just look at it objectively, right? It's just like watching a movie. Like, you know, sometimes we judge the guy in the movie and we're like cringing, going, oh, you're such an idiot. But most of the time you're just kind of, you know, most of the time you're just kind of like watching the movie and watching people do whatever it is they do. And you kind of expect them to do that because you kind of know how their character behaves and works. Hmm. You just do the same thing yourself. Idea of why we're doing what we're doing or why we're feeling what we're feeling. It's all happening automatically at subconscious levels, and the subconscious brain is orders of magnitude more power than things like 10 to the 6 more processing power than our cortex. But we try to run our world from here, which leads to a lot of stress, which leads to impairment of this, and then we're still trying to run this with an impaired, and then we damage it and we poison it and we sleep deprive it. And
so it seems like just a vicious cycle, and then there's just a handful or several ways to disrupt that.
Yeah.
But some of those...
Probably endless. There's probably endless number of ways to disrupt it and make it bad.
And I've talked to people who, you know, they're like, how do I get out of this thing? And it's like, sometimes it's not predictable. It's
right.
Like when something has to happen. A lot of people, you know, they may call it like rock bottom. People get so... They hit rock bottom. There's nothing left. And then that's when they become somebody else. Like they lose that sense of self. And once you lose that sense of self, then you can look at everything much more objectively and probably have a little more compassion on who you used to be.
It's hard to rebuild until you completely break down the facade, right? Until it all completely crumbles. You can't really see the picture that clearly. So what we tend to do is, as we start breaking, we try to shore that up. And sometimes we shore it up in good ways, and sometimes we shore it up in a dysfunctional way. But if you can just completely level it, you know, just bulldoze the whole thing, just go like, I'm starting from scratch. Now you have choice over how you behave around anything. You have choice about how you think about anything. But we're running patterns from shit that happened to us at 7 years old.
Yeah.
And most of us don't know that we're running those patterns.
Oh yeah, when I went and did ayahuasca, I went back to the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
And dealt with things that
somewhere around 5 to 7 is like where most of us have conscious memory and start
I went back to that and I was like, oh, okay, this is why I keep doing the things I'm doing at the age of like 32.
Because you've made that mean this. Like that stimulus means this.
At the age of 7.
Yeah.
And now that that's solved, a few months later, all those behaviors kind of like faded.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
Yeah. The brain is a curious machine.
We plowed right through that. No break.
We didn't do a break. I was kept on wanting to do a break, but then I was so interested in everything we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. How long do we go? We're
at hour 22 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, really good. Anything? I think we should call it good.
Wrap
here.
It up.
We can always
I don't know if we actually talked about anything useful, but it was interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to me. I don't know.
I think people are going to enjoy it. You do have one product, which I do use, which is Sleep Remedy.
Yep.
So if you do have trouble sleeping, I mean, who do you recommend that product to?
I recommend that to people who have difficulty sleeping. I recommend it to people for jet lag. If they're using, you can use it episodically to kind of recalibrate your circadian rhythm. But I also recommend it, and I don't have a bona fide clinical trial to validate this concept, but from the sleep studies that I have seen on people who take the product and from people's self-reported experience, people who just routinely get poor sleep or not enough sleep should probably be on it because it improves the quality of their sleep. It tends to improve the quality. They report improved quality or whatever. I don't want to get myself in trouble with the FTC, but you know, I see this all the time. People come back and say, like, I've had people come back and say they didn't, like, it makes them not snore anymore. And, like, you know, or your people on CPAP machines are like, you know, after 3 months of getting good quality sleep, I don't even need my CPAP machine anymore. Like, but so anyone who's on shift work, I mean, shift work is, you know, the World Health Organization has classified shift work as a type 2A carcinogen, which means that we pretty sure it causes cancer. But we aren't going to do research on humans to figure out if it causes cancer or not. So we call it a type 2A, but it really, it's on par with smoking cigarettes, right?
Like, yeah.
So we know it's really bad for you. So those people, I just say, you know, mitigate everything, right? It's just like, if you aren't going to move at all, optimize everything else you can possibly do, right? Like, optimize your nutrition, optimize your sleep, optimize your stress control. If you just refuse to move, then we'll make that the least impactful aspect as possible. So if you're just not going to get enough sleep because you're hard-headed and you think that, you know, in order to succeed, you can't sleep more than 5 hours, get the best quality you can. If you're, you know, a law enforcement officer and you work night shift every single night for 25 years, or not every night, but, you know, for your whole career, you're working night shift, you should probably be taking the product, right? We're just improving the quality of what you do get. Just like if somebody were just going to exercise occasionally, you would want them to do, like, you know, the ideal, most optimal workout for them. And that's really all it is. But again, nothing in there lasts very long. There's nothing sedating in there. There's no tricks in there. It's just what we talked about. You know, the melatonin production pathway, it's all the ingredients that lead to the production of melatonin. Your brain still has to do it. It has a very small amount of melatonin to initiate the cascade. And then it has a form of GABA that gets into the brain and does that thing that we talked about earlier, just lower the threshold, the resting potential of all those neurons so that you're not as aware of your environment. But if we did this right now, and if we drank it right now and did the podcast, we wouldn't even know we drank it, right? So you still have to do something right. You know, you still have to have some sort of preparatory pattern for getting yourself ready for sleep.
I take it with me when I travel. Yeah. Get in my room, hot water from the coffee maker. And then just mix that in with the hot water. And I do that before, like when I'm traveling, especially if I'm changing time zones or if I get home, I do it. Or if I was up all night dancing, it helps me.
I really take it every night. Ironically, I run out of it a lot. I happen to know a guy who can get it for me, but I run out of it all the time. Just because, whatever, I don't know. I don't think about it. And I live in two houses. So I have a house in San Diego and a house in Austin. And I go between the two. And just sometimes I get to the house and I'm like, I don't have any. I'll order some tomorrow.
I noticed that whoever owns that company set it up to where you can have subscription. Like, you have an auto ship to your house.
Could,
weird.
One could do that. Like a really smart, really smart guy would do that. But you know, I remember I hadn't taken it for probably 3 months at one point. It's the longest period I went without taking it since I put it on the market. Well, even before, because I was just taking it, like the SEALs were all taking it just in constituent parts. They were having to go out and buy all the ingredients separately. Right. So I've taken it on and off for years. But once I made it into an easy-to-use product, I just started using it every night. A lot of it had to do with me starting the sleep supplement business, being stressed out of my mind because I had no freaking idea what I was doing trying to start a supplement business. And then Rob Wolf comes over. We were both doing a gig somewhere. It might have been Seal Fit. I can't remember what it was, but we were both lecturing somewhere, and we were chatting, like, you know, little schoolgirls. And then he's like, "All right, I'm gonna do my sleep cocktail and go to bed." And he's like, "I got an extra one if you want." And I'm like, "Oh, no, I haven't had it in, like, months." And he's like, "Are you sure? I mean, you know," he's like his little drug dealer. He's waving it. I'm like, "All right, I'll do it." And then I woke up the next morning going, "Holy shit, why don't I take this ever? Like, what am I doing,
man?" It's your own stuff.
I'm like, how stupid do I have to be? But guess what? I've learned that I'm that stupid in a lot of areas. Like, I've gone so many times in my life, I've gone like 2 or 3 weeks where I hardly get any exercise and I feel like dog shit. And then I go exercise. I'm like, what the fuck was I thinking, man? Like, I'm a totally different person. And I've done that like 50 times in my life, man. So I don't know. I need to get slow that learner program. I'm a low slurner right there. Yeah.
Awesome.
All right, man.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yep.
Cool.
And we're back. And If you want to find out where you can find Kirk, find the sleep product, you can definitely check out barbellshrug.com. Go to the blog, check out the podcast, and we've got links in there. If people want to check out what you have going on, are you on social media?
DocParsley.com is my website, and I'm on social media. I'm pretty sure as Doc Parsley on most platforms. You know, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I have like 5 pictures up, I think, or something like that. yeah, but DocParsley.com is the easiest thing you can do. All my little social media links are on that, too. So
excellent.
Cool.